support from Radio Maria, featuring an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities. Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, celebrating the holiday season with the Champaign-Urbana Ballet's performances of The Nutcracker and A Scottish Christmas, featuring fiddler Bonnie Rideout and friends. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. On November 4th of this year, we marked the 25th anniversary of the beginning of the Iran hostage crisis. And when I say we marked it, I guess I should have to say that the chances are an awful lot of people didn't notice at all. It is an anniversary that over the years in this country hasn't gotten very much attention. And even apparently in Iran, interest in celebrating that day in recent years has declined. Back in 1979, a small group of Iranian students decided to take the U.S. Embassy compound in Tehran. And their idea was to, in a very public way, demonstrate a challenge to American influence and power. And they had in mind something would take 2 or 3 days to give them an opportunity to stand up and make statements, and that would be that. However, of course, as you remember, this stretched out well past the year mark. It took 444 days. Among other things, a lot of people would argue that it marked the end of Jimmy Carter's possibility of serving a second term. Also was the beginnings of militant Islam, which is now certainly a force in politics, and certainly to this day has colored the relationship between Iran and the United States. In this part of the show, we will look back to the Iran hostage crisis of 1979 as we talk with journalist David Harris, who has authored a new book on it. It's titled The Crisis. The subtitle is The President, the Prophet, and the Shah, 1979 and the Coming of Militant Islam. It's published by Little Brown, and it is out new in the bookstores. If you're interested in reading the book, it just came out a couple of weeks ago. You should be able to find it in the bookstore. And as we talk, of course, with our guest, David Harris, questions are welcome. The only thing that we ask, of course, of people of calling in is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Our guest, David Harris, is the author of several books, including The Last Stand, Shooting the Moon, and Our War. He's also written for The New York Times, Rolling Stone, and other publications. He's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Harris, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. What was it that made you want to concentrate? And obviously, this was a serious undertaking, took a great deal of research and a lot of time, I'm sure, spent to put this book together. What was it that one made you want to explore this particular piece of recent American history?
Well, it struck me that this whole episode, starting with the Shah of the Fall and ending with the final release of the American hostages, was really marked the template for our modern world, if you will. This was the first head-on collision with aroused Islam, and much of what transpired 25 years ago continues to rule the day in our relations with Islam as we speak.
Mm. I guess one of the big questions about how this played out starts with the idea that the students had of doing something that would get the attention of the world. It would give them the opportunity to give them a platform to speak from. But their idea was, you know, this would last a couple of days, and that would be that. How is it that something that started out like that ended up stretching on for more than a year?
Well, the short answer, of course, is that the response in Iran was so overwhelming that the students who had figured to play a kind of fringe role in the political situation in Iran, instead were thrust to the very epicenter of the revolution that was going on in Iran at that time. You have to picture that at this point, the Shah has been overthrown, has been out of the throne for almost 9 months, and during that time, he's basically been replaced with a kind of chaos, that a provisional government that had some powers, but justice was still being meted out on street corners. There was none of the stability that we associate with an established government. There was the attempt being made to finally establish an Islamic Republic to replace the Shah, but everything was in disorder and in extreme disagreement amongst all the factions that had made the revolution against the Shah in the first place. And suddenly these students acted. It struck a resonant chord. All the political factions in Iran at this point united behind their action. And the public at large started streaming out of the countryside into Tehran to take up vigil outside of the embassy and to express their support for the students. And facing that kind of response, the students suddenly recalculated and said they were going to stick around. Their motivation for doing this was their perception of what they expected the Americans to do at that moment in history. We had just admitted the Shah into the United States from his exile in Mexico for medical treatment, and they saw this as a replay of what had happened in 1953 when the United States had installed the Shah as the absolute power in Iran, destroying the embryonic loosely organized democratic government that had been left in place by the British after their occupation of Iran during World War II. And the students were expecting that was another replay, that the Americans, once they got the Shah in the country, would set about trying to reinstall him back in Iran. So in a strange way, this hostage episode was blowback from our first exercise in regime change in 1953 back in Iran.
And it was something that at the time probably many Americans had forgotten, if they knew anything about it at all, which I guess illustrates the fact that sometimes when we become involved in other countries, we forget at our peril that their memories are long, often longer than ours.
Considerably longer. We are the nation of the 30-second attention span, and not only do we know little about the history of the nations of the rest of the world that we deal with, we don't even remember our own history with them. You know, when we talk about intelligence failures, one of the intelligence failures that has gone on consistently is the larger American cultural intelligence failure to understand other cultures and what their experience of us is. And in this case, views were so divergent that the Americans could make no sense out of what would be motivating the Iranians, and the Iranians were in very much the same position.
What was Iran like during the time that the Shah was the ruler of the country?
Well, it went through a transformation that the Shah described as his white revolution, in which he perceived himself as the great modernizer of Iran and set about trying to make it the fourth greatest industrial power in the world. To do this, built roads, built dams, built schools, built industrial plants, was blessed in the latter stages of it with an enormous influx of money from Iran's oil holdings, which are the second largest in the world, and used that to try and make Iran into a state that was not a third world state, but a first world state on the par with the great Western nations. This was his vision, and he took significant steps towards that. That, in turn, however, also set up the opposition to him, because this was enormously disruptive in a traditional culture. Peasants who had been living on the countryside were suddenly evicted from the countryside, forced into the cities, where they became, you know, cement workers or welders or whatever work they could find in this new industrial Iran, were faced with a kind of cosmopolitan culture that they had never encountered before. Among other things, this great dislocation of the Iranian population set off a religious revival during the 1970s in Iran that ultimately found form in the opposition to the Shah himself.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll bring them into the conversation. Again, I just real quick introduce our guest. We're talking with journalist David Harris. He's written several books, and his new one is about the Iranian Revolution of 1979 and the hostage crisis. The title of the book is The Crisis. It's published by Little Brown and just came out late last month. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have someone here in Indiana, a toll-free line. We'll go right there first. Hello.
Hello. I'm trying to check my memory, and I'd wonder if you could say something roughly from the time period where the helicopter was downed to the time that the plane trip had been made with the missiles to the final release of the hostages. And I particularly remember, I don't know if this is just a bias that shows up in my memory or whether this was actually a worthwhile question back then, whether or not the Reagan's people before the election got to people who had connections with the hostages and started setting things up then and asking them to wait till after the election before they made any decisions. Thanks.
Okay. Well, the caller poses a number of questions. Maybe to take the last one, that's one of those enduring things that people have talked about ever since, the suspicion that somehow this was when Mr. Reagan was first running for president against Jimmy Carter, this suspicion that somehow people connected with the Reagan campaign made contact with the government in Iran and the people who are holding a hostage and said, wait, hold them until after the election. Did you find any evidence that such a thing took place?
Well, this is the so-called October surprise, and certainly that allegation has been out there. It was made in several very visible books that came out in the 1980s eventually provoked a congressional investigation that pretty much debunked most of the evidentiary basis that these claims had been made on. So that ultimately the investigation concluded that there was no evidence to prove these charges. This is, however, is believed extensively on the Iranian side. One of the people I interviewed for this book is Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, who was the first elected president of the Islamic Republic and a key figure in the Iranian Revolution. And Bani Sadr recounts being approached in the summer of 1980 before the American elections that fall, and by relative of Khomeini's, who came to him and said that he had just had a meeting with the American Republicans in Spain, and that they wanted to make a deal surrounding the hostages and the timing of the hostage release, and did Bani Sadr want to be in on the deal? Bani Sadr said he didn't want anything to do with that, and so was not included on it, but drew the conclusion, which he holds to this day, that indeed the Islamic Republican Party, which was the party of the mullahs at this point in Iran, had made such a deal with the Republicans around the timing of it. Another one, an Iranian who believed that, was Sadegh Hoxhabadeh, who was at the time the foreign minister of Iran, who, when he resigned in August of 1980, published a long public letter in which he devoted a couple paragraphs to the possibility that, which he said was an actuality, that the Islamic Republican Party had made a deal with the American Republican Party. So I think this is one of those things that we will never be able to prove or disprove, but certainly there isn't substantial enough evidence to make this kind of charge of essentially treason against the Republican Party and its presidential candidate.
I think it's interesting that looking at the book, I guess I didn't really realize that it was, in fact, the Republicans who coined the term, and their concern was that somehow Mr. Carter would manage to get the hostages released right before the election.
Yeah, their polling showed that if Carter was able to get the hostages released essentially during the month of October, that he would probably swing at least 10 points in the poll, and of course at the in the election, and that would be enough for him to carry the election, because all the way up to the actual date of the election, this race was nip and tuck, too close to call, although eventually all the undecideds fell against Carter and gave Reagan an enormous electoral victory. That wasn't clear until 24 hours before the voting that was going to happen.
Hmm. I think the caller was also interested in talking about the rescue attempt, and I think maybe what I would like to do is say we will get to that in a little bit. Why don't we hold off on that, and I'd like to get another caller in here, and then, of course, we'll continue to talk with our guest, David Harris. The next person in line here is in Champaign, and that would be in line number one.
Hello. Thank you. I want to applaud WILL, as usual, for being the only news source which has covered actually Iranian history. They've had a number of speakers over the last year, and I think most people who aren't familiar with at least modern history would know the importance of this whole area of Iran, Iraq, and Syria during World War II and why perhaps the Cold War decisions were made. Just something I note is that there is this discussion of chaos after the revolution, but when we look at the almost illegally criminal state that was in power in Iran, it makes sense why people were on the quad in 1976 when I was a freshman at the university, wearing masks with the, at that time, down with the Shah was the chant. Kill the Shah did not come until almost a year and a half later. But so the history of this is just incredible, but the part I've never understood is about perhaps the Middle Eastern history and tradition of taking hostages. I think that's something that to me today is still clueless as we're dealing with the hostage taking in our current military conflict. What is the history of hostage taking? Because I think that's the clear misunderstanding is maybe they're engaging in a kind of feudal consensus politics that involves the holding of hostages and the taking of hostages, and we just totally don't understand it. I don't understand it. So thank you.
Right.
Well, I certainly wouldn't put myself forward as an expert on hostage taking, but in my own research, one of the things that became apparent was that hostage taking is a far more traditional means of action in that culture than it is in ours. It's unknown in ours, but to seal a bargain in that part of the world, often hostages were given and hostages were held in order to ensure that bargains were lived up to, so that. This was a far more traditional and, if you will, accepted procedure than anything that we could imagine. Certainly, we treated it as an outrage from the beginning without any of that kind of cultural understanding. Even with the cultural understanding, it may be an outrage, and certainly it was a violation of the rules of diplomacy in no uncertain terms, which even the Iranians understood. They felt that they were justified in doing so, because of the larger math, if you will, of the relations between the United States and Iran. They felt that the United States had held Iran hostage for the previous 25 years by installing the Shah as government, and as its first act of foreign aid to Iran after it installed the Shah, they helped organize SAVAK, the state security apparatus that eventually tortured tens of thousands of Iranians and implemented the Shah's rule with an iron fist. So there was more to their logic of hostage-taking than meets the eye to the average American, certainly.
All right, let's go to someone on a cell phone here, line number four. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah, since I'm on a cell phone, I'll make a couple of quick comments and hang up and you can answer. Very enjoyable show. The one comment that was made, I didn't realize when you mentioned that the United States brought the Shah back to the country and the students were afraid that he was going to regain power. From what I can remember, I thought he was pretty badly off with cancer and near death, so maybe the students didn't realize that, or maybe that didn't fall into the equation. But the other comment I had was, from what I read and what I've seen about Jimmy Carter, that this whole episode completely possessed him. He was not able to detach himself from it, and consequently lived and died almost every day with this crisis. You know, so I would just be curious as to your comments on that. And then finally, the actual takeover itself, was it accomplished fairly easily? You know, was it just kind of a mass invasion, or was there any planning to it? And I'll hang up. Thank you.
Okay, so let me pick the middle question the caller asked, simply because I think that also helps to explain. I asked a little earlier about how it is that this thing that the students intended to be an event of a couple of days stretched out into more than a year. You talked a little bit about how people in Iran very quickly came, sort of rallied around the students and came to support it, and it became sort of, as far as the Iranians were concerned and the students, a different sort of thing. You also, when you ask this question, how is it that it managed to stretch into 444 days, you also have to look at the American reaction, which may indeed go to Mr. Carter's personal reaction.
Absolutely. You know, as one of the hostages pointed out to me when I interviewed him, if you're bargaining with an Iranian at the bazaar, if you're going to be able to make a deal, the one thing you have to be able to do is walk away from the stall and threaten to collapse the deal altogether before you're going to be able to make a deal. And such was our obsession with this event and the holding of the hostages that there was never a point where we could walk away from the stall. We were stuck in it, and they knew we were stuck in it, which only increased its value to them in terms of their own internal politics. And certainly Jimmy Carter walked right into that. You know, in the initial days of the crisis, Carter was scheduled to take a trip to Canada, which he intended to do, but his chief advisor, Hamilton Jordan, came to him and said, look, in this circumstance, you can't leave the country. You know, people will never understand. They want you to be in Washington at the helm of the ship. And so Carter canceled his trip to Canada, and then started canceling every other trip outside of Washington that he was supposed to make, and got himself cornered so that it was now the assumption in the Carter White House that nothing was more important and that Carter could not go out, leave the helm of the ship, if you will, until this was dealt with. So that he spent the next 6 months in what was called the Rose Garden strategy, where he basically never left the White House, and this became his paramount concern. And I think was on a very emotional level for Carter. You know, Carter was identified with the people who worked for him, and in this case, those diplomats were being held hostage, and they were his primary concern, and lasted as his primary concern for the rest of his presidency from November 2nd of 1979 on.
Mm-hmm. Going to the last question the caller asked, and I suppose that again is one of the things when you think back, one of the basic questions is how is it that a handful of students managed to take over an American embassy? And certainly there were guards. In fact, one of the Marine guards lives here in Champaign-Urbana in the area.
There were certainly Marine guards, but not in sufficient numbers to be able to really keep any significant crowd off of an embassy. You know, we're talking a couple dozen Marines at the max, so that, you know, we shouldn't assume that there was the military capacity there to seriously repel. What we were counting on, of course, was the protection supposed to be provided by the host government, which had a group of Revolutionary Guards stationed around the embassy to protect it, and had been doing a significant job of protecting it. This, again, is surrounded by the chaos of going on Tehran when there were almost daily marches of as many as a million people at a time, often going by the American embassy shouting, Marghbar America, death to America. The Revolutionary Guards that were there had succeeded in basically protecting them from this crowd. In this case, the Revolutionary Guards had cut a deal with the students to let them in, so they just simply climbed over the gate and were inside the compound. The Americans shut themselves into the Chancery building, kind of like a turtle locked up in its shell, and ultimately were forced to surrender. And there were no physical means to resist this. Ironically, this was taken as a great surprise by Americans. This was some kind of ambush they had never imagined. But the truth was that this possibility had been part of American calculations for for 9 months almost leading up to the takeover of the embassy. On Valentine's Day of that year, in February, the embassy had been taken before. A group of armed leftist guerrillas had attacked with automatic weapons, seized the 26-acre embassy compound, and seized the diplomats and held them for a couple hours until the provisional government was able to intervene and convince the leftists to leave. So from that point on, the possibility that the embassy would be taken in the fashion that it was part of American calculations. And every time the Carter White House asked the embassy if they should admit the Shah to the United States, the embassy responded every time that if you do so, we cannot guarantee the safety of the embassy or of the diplomats that are here. And in fact, the embassy was running on a relatively skeletal basis by the time that it was finally taken over, without nearly the staffing it normally has, and with a lot of its documents shipped back to the United States for protection. Mm.
Also, the caller asked the question about, you were talking about the fact that the Iranian students, when the Shah was admitted, and he was admitted to the United States for medical treatment, they started to worry that perhaps this was a sign that the United States intended to put the Shah back into power. The fact is that he was very ill, and I don't believe lived very much longer after that. Were the details about his medical condition known enough so that people would have known that that certainly he didn't have that long to live at that point?
Well, his medical condition had been hidden quite successfully. I mean, he had been suffering from a lymphoma that was first diagnosed in 1974, and his own wife did not even find out he had it for 3 years after he was diagnosed. He refused to go any hospitals because that would give a clear indication that he was indeed sick, and he thought that would be used by his enemies. His illness had never been made public and was unknown until right before he asked to enter the United States and revealed that he, in fact, was suffering from cancer. And the cancer was extreme, and indeed he was a dying man, and he would die within 8 months after he entered the United States. This was not known to the Iranians, and they did not trust the American version of that. When the American embassy sent a delegation over to meet with the provisional government before they admitted the Shah and told them that they were going to let the Shah into the country, one of the things the provisional government asked for was, can we have an Iranian doctor examine these records and the Shah himself to verify that indeed he is ill? The Americans refused that request every time it was made, and it was made a number of occasions. So for most Iranians, they thought this was more American perfidy and that they were not going to accept the United States' word that, in fact, the Shah was this kind of sick. And even if he was sick and wasn't a threat, most Iranians felt that they had the right to bring him back to Iran and try him for the crimes that he had committed against the Iranian people. Not unlike how the Iraqis seemed to be intending to deal with Saddam Hussein. And they felt they had the right to get this criminal back, who they felt had not only abused them, but stolen a great deal of their money. And that was also motivating the students. But nobody in Iran accepted that the Shah was this kind of sick.
We're a little bit past our midpoint. We have another caller we will get right to. I would like to reintroduce our guest for the benefit of anybody who's just tuned in. We're talking with David Harris. He's the author of a number of books, including a brand new one that's titled The Crisis, The President, the Prophet, and the Shah, 1979, and the Coming of Militant Islam. It's published by Little Brown. David Harris has written for a number of publications, including The New York Times and Rolling Stone, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have another caller here, someone in Rantoul nearby, line number one. Hello.
Hello, yes. Thank you for having Mr. Harris on. The first point I was going to make, you've already alluded to, and the fact that I believe the gentleman's name is Paul Davis, a local businessman.
Lewis.
Who was a Marine.
Paul Lewis.
Paul Lewis, thank you. He's a local businessman now, and he was a Marine hostage at the embassy. I was thinking it would be interesting if he were to be hearing this program and call in. That would have some unique insights there. I have a couple of questions for Mr. Harris. They're more general, but I'm sure he has thought and pondered these. My first one is, how much do you think the hatred of the United States and the Middle East in general is based on our complete support for Israel, and how much of it is based on our desire and our past actions to control that area for American business? And the second question is, and obviously this is speculation, but how do you think this current situation that we find ourselves in the Middle East, meaning the United States, will change or work itself out? And I would like to hang up and listen to that answer, please.
All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me start with the issue of hatred for the United States. I think while we tend to perceive that hatred as somehow emerging out of the cosmos in direct form, as though simply by virtue of who we are, people hate us. In fact, in practical ways, it has a great deal more to do with the way we have behaved historically than some kind of cultural resentment per se. I think, obviously, in Iran, there was an enormous resentment for the support of the United States for the dictator that had been ruling the country, and who many perceived as an abomination. And that there was a desire to hold the United States accountable for that. I think certainly looking at the wider region, our alliance with Israel and continued support of the Israeli positions, whatever they might be, has significantly undercut our standing in the Islamic world. And our refusal to recognize that situation, how important that situation is one of the things that continues to exacerbate it. But I think it's a mixture of a number of elements that breeds this kind of hatred. But I think most of them have to do not with some kind of cosmic principle, but with our own behavior. In terms of how the current situation is going to play out, boy, I wish I really understood that. You know, if I had the answer to that, I would be in a far better position than I am. I think that we have allowed ourselves to be maneuvered into a position where we are perceived as the enemies of Islam, and as long as we are in that position, we are in a no-win situation. And the task facing us is to figure out how we develop a new kind of relationship with these people, and I think the beginning of it is to simply engage in dialogue. You know, one of the amazing things about our relations with Iran is that during this entire hostage crisis, there were only twice that there was a direct connection between an official of the United States and an official of the Islamic Republic, both of those as part of secret negotiations that were never made public until well after the fact. There has been, in the 25 years since the crisis was over, there has been no direct contact. Our relations with Iran are continuing to be funneled through the Swiss embassy there. We are not engaged in any kind of direct conversation. And I think it's impossible for us to imagine a way out of the situation if we don't at least begin to talk and begin to develop some standards for behavior that all the countries in that part of the world and ourselves can live up to. I mean, for example, the current crisis with Iran's desire to develop its nuclear capacities, at least for a peaceful generation of electricity, and with some possibility that this might be being used as a potential base for weapon systems. To approach this situation simply by claiming this is an Iranian problem misses the scope of what we're dealing with. Weapons of mass destruction are attractive to all kinds of governments in the world because they are a leverage, and they, at least in today's world, they are the one guarantee that the Americans will not invade and change your regime, is the possession of those kind of weapons and your ability to use them. Certainly in that region where we have already accepted the illegal development of atomic weapons by Pakistan, our ally, and by Israel, our ally, said nothing about those, have made no attempts to redress that violation of international standards, and now essentially have adopted a policy of towards weapons of mass destruction that we get to choose whoever is going to have them and who is not going to have them, which is no way to reach any kind of solution. You know, I think we're going to have to step back and find genuine international solutions that are not dictated by us if we're going to find answers in that part of the world.
I want to go back to one of the questions an earlier caller asked. I believe he was interested in having you talk about the rescue attempt, which ultimately was a failure. How was it that the administration decided to choose those means and to try to use military force to get the hostages? And how is it that it seemed in so many respects to go wrong?
Well, and when the hostages were first taken, there was the immediate impulse to find some kind of military action with which to rescue them. Remember, in the context of the time, the Israelis several years before had rescued some Israeli hostages from Entebbe in Africa, and this was kind of the model that was being held up. The United States had just formed and gone through the initial training of its first kind of anti-terrorist commando group, the Delta Force, and immediately as the crisis broke out, the Joint Chiefs of Staff reported that there was no military means that they could take in the immediate moment, but they proceeded to plan this mission and do training for it as a possibility down the line. In the meantime, Carter looked for ways to negotiate with the Iranians, which was difficult because it was hard to find somebody to talk to. Ultimately, there was a set of secret negotiations in which Hamilton Jordan represented the United States and ended up having a secret meeting with Sadegh Hotsepeh, who was at that time the foreign minister of Iran, attempting to work out some kind of scenario whereby the Iranians' demands could be satisfied, the Americans could get their hostages back, and the situation could be resolved. They went through several attempts at working that out until finally, by the April of 1980, the last of those attempts fell through. Carter lost his patience and was advised by his military advisors that if he wanted to do this rescue mission, he was going to have to do it soon because the logistics involved would change when summer began and the nights became shorter. And so he made the decision at that point to go forward with it. He made that decision in a meeting where Secretary of State Cyrus Vance was not even present. He was out of town at the time, didn't learn about it till after he came back. Vance made a futile attempt to try and convince him to change his mind and convince the rest of the presidential advisors to do the same, and was unsuccessful at that, and so handed in his resignation before the mission was launched. The mission his complaint about the mission was this was an enormously complex military operation, and his experience previously at the Defense Department was whenever you had an enormously complex operation like this, something always went wrong, and something would go wrong with this, and this was the planning on this was so tight that if anything went wrong, it was not going to work. The plan was essentially this, to dispatch the American Delta Force in some C-130 transports. They would rendezvous with a corps of 8 helicopters flown off of an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf. They would rendezvous in the unoccupied Iranian desert. At that point, the Delta Force would board the helicopters. The helicopters would refuel on the fuel brought in by the C-130s. Then the helicopters would fly to a location outside of Tehran, where everybody would hide this staging was all done at night. As daylight came, they were supposed to be at their hiding place. They would hide there all day during the daylight. The following night, some Central Intelligence Agency spies that had been infiltrated into Tehran would come out and meet them with trucks. The Delta Force would drive into Tehran in trucks, reach the embassy, blow through the embassy wall, kill as many of the students as they ran into, grab the hostages, take them across the street to a soccer stadium where the helicopters would arrive, pick everybody up, fly them to an abandoned military base outside of Tehran where American C-130s would fly in again, the helicopters would be abandoned and everybody would be flown out. That was the plan. The plan only got as far as the desert itself. What would have happened if they had gotten into Tehran is an open question. The only study the government did of what was going to come down if this plan went forward was done by the CIA several weeks before the mission took off. Its calculation was that if the mission went forward, that probably 60% of the hostages would have been killed in the process. We will never know that because when they landed out in the desert, things had already started going wrong. The helicopters had had a horrible trip in. They'd been through two sandstorms to get across the Great Iranian Desert. When they finally landed, three of the helicopters had been disabled and couldn't go forward. That left them with only five helicopters, which was not enough lifting power to perform the mission. So they had to abort it and then turn everybody around to go home. In the process of turning around to go home, one of the helicopters ran into one of the fuel planes. There was an explosion. Eight Americans were burned to death. Helicopters had to be abandoned, in some cases including the high-security papers in them that described the mission that they were on, which were not destroyed before they left. And the whole operation came home in an abject failure. The Iranians never even knew it was happening until the United States announced that they had tried it and it had failed. Mm. And it was simply beyond our military reach. We were trying to do something that we did not have the wherewithal to do. And this was part of the larger, I think, frustration that really defined the American end of the crisis, which was one of being confronted with our own impotence in the situation. We were dealing with something we could not control, and the timing of which we couldn't control. Ultimately, to resolve this, we had to be patient, wait for the Iranian internal political situation to sort itself out, and when that happened, ultimately, there were successful negotiations that brought the hostages home. But, of course, not in time to save Jimmy Carter in that election.
Yeah. Just have a couple of people I want to get to, but another point I think that's really interesting is when one thing that we know that we've heard a lot about with the current administration and its policy in the Middle East and the decision to go into Iraq is about infighting within the administration, very strong differences of opinion about which way to go, particularly between the Department of State and the security advisor at the White House and the Pentagon. And I suppose we shouldn't think that something like that would be so unusual. Probably a lot of that goes on in every administration. But in this particular case, there was indeed a lot of argument within the cabinet and within the White House, between the security advisor, between the Secretary of State, between people who are advising the president. And that certainly didn't help Mr. Carter.
Absolutely. No, there was that the Pentagon didn't play a big role in that division in this administration, but the division was between the Secretary of State and the State Department and the National Security Council and the National Security Advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski. And that division was dramatic and had been part of the administration throughout its tenure, was a big source of disagreement when the Shah was falling, was a big source of disagreement about how to relate to the Iranian Revolution after the Shah fell, and was a big source of disagreement about how to relate to the hostage crisis, where essentially Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor, was constantly looking for more forceful military means to regain the national honor, as he saw it. Vance was looking for ways to ameliorate the situation, to come to some common terms, and to bring his diplomats home. So these two forces were at extreme odds inside the administration. It certainly didn't help anything, and ultimately led to Vance leaving the administration over this issue.
Let's talk with some other callers. Next up, Champagne, line one.
Hi, great discussion. The speaker had mentioned in the 1970s there was a religious revival. Could you mention about in Iran today if religion's very important? You know, there is the theocracy there, but are most Iranians very religious, and were they prior to the revolution? Could you talk about that?
Well, certainly there's been, as in any culture in Iran, there's been an ebb and flow of that kind of religious fervor. And perhaps there was never a point where it was higher than during the days that I've written the crisis about. Part of that was just the person of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, who was the great leader, who is a hard figure for us as Americans to imagine because was like a combination of both the president and the pope at the same time, and a man of enormous religious standing who also had enormous political standing because of his long-time opposition to the Shah, who was the figurehead of an enormous revolution inside Iran. I mean, when he returned to Iran from exile after the Shah had left, 10 million Iranians, according to Le Monde correspondent who was there at the time, turned out into the streets to welcome him home. I mean, 10 million, we're talking about greater Chicago and greater Los Angeles out in the streets together to welcome one man home. And there was an incredible burst of religious fervor that that joined forces with the nationalism of that has always been true of the Persian culture. And in the years since, I think a lot of that fervor has ebbed. The by taking power, the religious forces have lost some of their credibility ultimately because they're held responsible for the state of affairs, and that kind of discreditation has been going on pretty steadily inside Iran on a cultural level. I don't think it's to the point that there's going to be any kind of political revolution against it per se, but there's an enormous cultural revulsion with the kind of control that the religious leadership has brought, certainly amongst the educated parts of the population and those parts of the population that are a little better off and want to be part of the kind of world culture. And so certainly I would say that religious fervor in Iran today is not nearly as remarkable as it was 25 years ago, but it's still an enormous factor and obviously holds sway.
Could I ask another question about that?
Sure, sure.
Would 10 million people have turned out in the streets to welcome a communist or a greater democracy advocate? Was religion so essential to this opposition to the Shah, or if anybody else had been a strong critic of the Shah, would they have been so well received by the people of Iran?
No, nobody but Khomeini would have gotten that response because of his kind of legendary status. It was always an assumption amongst the Iranian revolutionaries, even the secular ones and even the communist ones, that the only way that they would be able to get to the masses in order to really make their case against the Shah was to get in through the mosques.
I see.
That was the mass base, and that's what brought not just the intelligentsia to this issue, who had been to this issue for a long time, but also brought the average Iranian working stiff out.
Mm-hmm.
So the mosques provided an enormous base for the revolution, and it could not have succeeded without it. It was that confluence of the political and the religious coming together that made this revolution happen. But the Iranian revolution was remarkable because it involved the entire spectrum of Iranian political positions all joining together and accepting the leadership of Khomeini. Many of these factions at the time they were making the revolution of the Shah against the Shah thought that they could use Khomeini. He was an old man, a religious figure. They figured that they could use him for their purposes and discard him when the time came. And it happened to work the opposite way, where Khomeini used the secular and political forces for his own ends until he didn't need them anymore, then he discarded them. Witness the fate of two of those of the leaders of the secular part of the Iranian revolution who were incredibly critical were Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, who became the first president and eventually was forced into exile, now lives outside of Paris, and Sadegh Hotzpadeh, the foreign minister, who had been a key revolutionary figure who ultimately was executed by Khomeini in 1982. So what happened was the people who were trying to ride the fox across the river ended up in the belly of the fox.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Let's try and get at least one more. We'll go here to Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi. There's a little time. I wanted to mention you sort of, on the October surprise, I know it's a very complicated story, and you don't want to, you didn't rule it out, but I think we should mention Bob Perry's excellent new work on this, as well as the Gary Sick book that was written contemporaneously. And it ties into what you were just talking about with the other caller, which is this: there was a large secular part of the revolution, Bani Sadr being the most important of that. And if there was this kind of betrayal, it set the stage for the further betrayal of the deals with the mullahs in the Iran-Contra crisis. And basically what it implies is that it cemented the rule of the Islamists. And I don't know if that's something you dwell on. I know one of your major points of the book is that, this is where radical Islam was nurtured and fed. But if the betrayal really happened, as there is new evidence of it, keeping that quiet would have cost hush money as well, and it sort of cemented, which is, you know, betraying the left. The secular left was one thing that the Reagan administration saw as its grand mission as well. So if you could, I don't know if you can tie that all together or untie it in a couple of minutes here, but I appreciate the show. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly the betrayal of the secular left inside of Iran was going on simultaneously to the hostage crisis, and indeed, the hostage crisis was one of the principal political implements used by the religious right inside of Iran to solidify its power. It enabled them to keep the population in a state of arousal, if you will, and exercised over the Americans and the role of the Americans, and caught up in their visceral response to the Americans and their role in Iranian history, and obfuscated a number of the other issues of the possible totalitarian possibilities that were coming along with the Islamic Republic that was addressing these questions. I think as long as they needed that state of anger out in the population, they worked the hostage crisis as much as they could. When an Islamic government had been finally established and the mullahs were in control of the new Iranian parliament and were rapidly taking control of the executive branch, and Khomeini had been established as the supreme religious guide of the new Islamic Republic, they didn't need to do that anymore, and they could then switch and make negotiations with the Americans. But the possibility of that deal between the mullahs and the Americans was a political issue after the hostages were released. And in the final showdown between Bonnie Sauter and the religious forces inside of Iran, Bonnie Sauter became the principal critic of the deal that had been cut with the Americans and the process whereby it had been cut. And part of the reason that he became such a threat that he was forced out of the country was his insistence on talking about that subject. I don't know if that helps.
And we're going to have to stop, and I'm really sorry. I'm sure we could keep going. It's a very complicated story. There are a lot of facets, and if people are interested in reading more, they should definitely look at the book that I mentioned a couple of times here by our guest. And again, the title of the book is The Crisis, The President, the Prophet, and the Shah, 1979, and the Coming of Militant Islam. It's published by Little Brown, just out now, by our guest, David Harris. And Mr. Harris, we want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
The broadcast today made possible with support from Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing service to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 367-8888. Also, funds come from a grant from the Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at the Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. That's it for us. We want you to stay tuned, though. Coming up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll take a look at HIP.